I've just pressed the record button and we're in business.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercip. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film and music and theatre, television, books, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
And in fact, that basically this week it's dedicated to Amy Adams.
Yes, it is.
Which is not entirely a bad thing because she is a fantastic actress. And this week she's leading the way in both the sci-fi hit Arrival and the... We'll figure out what adjectives to apply to nocturnal animals.
Yes, I had a couple. You may not agree with them. I thought it was noirishly, if there's such a word, noirishly disturbing.
Oh, it's certainly noirish and disturbing in disturbingly noirish ways.
Excellent. So, actually, we talk about Amy Adams, but both these films, Nocturnal Animals and Arrival, had some pretty classy actors on display. Are these films a good watch? Both of them have endings which might, you know, have you talking for a bit, for good or for ill. So we'll see.
This is indeed true. Aside from films, I've been getting back to my Manchester music roots a little bit. One of the mainstays of the Manchester scene back in the 80s and 90s, James, came to New Zealand for the first time last week, and I had the good fortune to be there.
Oh, good stuff. And I have read a book. And if you know anything about my musical tastes, which is hard for me to disguise, it'll be no surprise which book that is. It is, of course, yes, Bruce Springsteen's autobiography called, what else, Born to Run.
Is it any good?
Yes. And you might just wonder what... I'll get into the big my schmozzle about that. You might be wondering, Steve, I know it's on the tip of your tongue, why has it taken me so long to tell you about this, right? Because it's been out for a while.
I've been wondering how you've managed to restrain and contain yourself this long.
Yes, I know. How could I? Well, actually, there is a bit of a tale behind why I'm a little tardy in my reporting on this book, which I'll get to just a bit later in the podcast, the Crave podcast. But, Steve, shall we start with those Amy Adams films that we've both been to see?
Don't we? Where should we go first?
Well, let's start with Arrival. There's a lot to say about that. I mean, it's certainly a serious science fiction drama.
Yes.
But boy, does it have an ending, which I have to say for me, look, it had me sitting there for a moment or two or three thinking, you know, wondering to myself, geez, what do I make of all this? what was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was, this is slow. This is ponderous. This is stretching out. This is going nowhere. Can we please figure out what this film is about?
Ooh. All right. And now in terms of what it is, the basic... setting of it, can you perhaps wrap this up for us?
Well, the basic premise is Amy Adams plays Dr. Louise Banks. She's a linguistics professor somewhere in, I believe, Montana in the US, which is very convenient because Montana is one of the dozen sites around the world where aliens have chosen to make their first contact. And these great big, huge, big, the shells they call them, big black things that hang in the sky in exactly the same way that bricks don't. Thank you to Douglas Adams for that line. And she's approached by Forrest Whitaker, who plays a US Army colonel. And because she's a linguist, she knows everything there is to know about languages. Because apparently she translated some Farsi for them the previous year for the Army. And so she's hauled in to try and translate alien. Because apparently she can figure out how to speak alien, apparently. And while she's there, she meets up with Ian Donnelly, played by Jeremy Renner, who is a theoretical physicist who apparently has a fantastic knowledge of linguistics rather conveniently as well.
And it's very convenient, yes.
So it's her job to communicate with the aliens. And basically, that's it.
Yeah, and at the same time as she's doing that, other language experts in other countries are facing up to the same problem because other alien craft have landed all over the world. And, you know, all the time this, you know, human suspicion and fear bubbles up and, you know, what I guess the unfolding arc of the drama is what will what appears to start off as a civilized attempt to communicate with aliens, could it descend into some sort of, you know, conflict? And the other thing, perhaps, Steve, we should just briefly mention is while all this is unfolding in the film, I'm just going to use... not go overboard with my description of this. We do see scenes of Amy Adams's character Louise dealing with a personal tragedy,
yes.
And that comes in and out of the film, and that's probably enough if I need to say about that. But it's important to way the story develops.
It is quite important to where the story develops, but we don't really know why. And this sort of feeds into, I think, one of my big problems with the film is I'm not convinced that they pulled everything together and redeemed it from being, to use your word, a pile of schmaltz.
Well, I don't think it was completely a pile of schmaltz. There was an element of that at the end, but I actually don't agree with you on your comment there, Steve, about the pace of it, because I really enjoyed that part of it, mainly because it was just a bit of a change from all the, you know, the likes of Star Wars or Guardians of the Galaxy, all that sort of popcorn matinee fantasy stuff we've been seeing lately. This was much more on the vein of a 2001 Space Odyssey or even an Interstellar, you know, more of a serious sci-fi. And I didn't mind that. You're right. You're absolutely right that it was slow. The director was Denis Villeneuve, and he takes a very thoughtful, reflective, you know, approach to the storytelling. As you say, the camera shots linger. But I just thought, well, I don't know. They're trying to sort of give us an idea of how a reasonable-minded and intelligent person might approach trying to communicate with an alien life form, and how human anxieties get in all the way of that. So I was happy to go along with that part of it. I didn't mind the slow pace. For me, there was a sort of build-up of tension. As you say, the mystery of what the heck's going on here and how it all fits together, I didn't mind that. I was quite happy to go along with that. You found that just too drawn out, did you?
Yeah, I mean, you make a couple of comments I'm going to pull together there. You're saying that it echoes 2001, for example, and I think Villeneuve would like nothing more than to have you think of 2001 when you watch it. I think he's – and the other phrase the word you used was trying. And I think it tried very, very hard. And I think that was possibly its big downfall, is I think it tried just a little bit too hard. And it, as a result, there's, for example, that if you remember the first scene when Banks and Donnelly enter the spaceship.
Yeah.
It is drawn out. It is protracted. It is, it's very atmospheric and moody. And there's a wonderful big swirling score going around it. But this film is 2 hours long, and it's based on a short story. And I think that is a dichotomy that doesn't work. They've taken thin gruel for a full-length feature film, and they've stretched it a little bit too thin. I mean, for example, tell me more about Louise Banks' character. What do we know of her?
Okay. Well, what will we know of her? Well, actually, the answer to that question is, because of the way the story develops, I think we don't want to know too much about her, or at least part of who she is kind of held back from us, isn't it? Other than the fact that she's this expert in linguistics and language and translation.
I think that's a very polite way of saying there's no character development.
Well, it's a character development in reverse, I suppose, but that's part of the story. I mean, I just think, I mean, these things are all very... in the end, they're very personal about what connects with you. I hear what you're saying about the ponderousness of it, and that the music, as you're right, it's very moody. It's all classical stuff. But I guess what they're trying to say is, well, if we really, really were going to meet an alien life form for the very first time, isn't that an incredibly portentous thing? And aren't we going to – we're going to dwell on this for a while. We're not going to rush into it. We're going to show you that – this is a big deal, and we're taking our time with it. I could still go along with that. Anyway, we'll agree to disagree with that one.
But no, we won't, because I'm going to give you some more evidence to support my argument here.
Oh, okay.
Almost exactly halfway through the film, exactly an hour into it, after you've had this very slow, very moody, very 2001 style pacing, suddenly you get about a 45-second voiceover recap and exposition, and then suddenly it switches gears and starts to resemble something. It starts to approach almost a psychological thriller, but not quite. And then the reveals come, and it's almost like somebody said, "Look, you need to pick the pace up on this, boys, because it's taking far too long to get anywhere." It was an oddly confused paced film.
I took the build up of the increased pace of the Amy Adams character's backstory, or whatever the word is to use, as just part of the build-up of dramatic tension. That's how I viewed it watching it. But what about the acting? Well, I thought the acting overall was pretty good. No one in this film, in keeping with the tone that director set, was going histrionic with their acting, were they? It was all pretty low-key and sort of, it was sort of, for want of a better word, a realistic take on the roles rather than a superhero take.
Exactly. I mean, there was very little personal conflict for the characters to deal with. And, you know, Jeremy Renner's character, Ian Donnelly, goes on no kind of journey whatsoever in this film. He has no character development. He has very little to work with. We don't really get a whole lot of him. Now, you know, we're used to seeing him in the Marvel-ish type films. That's where we usually see him. And yeah, he must have been pleased with the fact that he actually got to draw breath between lines. But he didn't really have a whole lot going on. We don't know. Other than, he's a physicist. Great. Yeah. Excellent. Tell me more about him. Nothing was done with his character, really.
The only thing I mostly agree with that we do see that, and he's a proper well brought up young man who is clearly beginning to have an affection for Amy Adams, but is trying to sort of keep his mind on the job, and that sort of bubbles along. But there's one before we discuss the ending, you and I, Steve, which is what a twist. There's one other thought I had watching this film, and it just rattled around the back of my brain, where there is a battle, and that is one of the countries which is dealing with this the aliens takes a bit more of a militaristic and combative approach,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And this country is, I was thinking, that just... I thought, well, what's going on here? The country concerned is a country where more and more Western filmmakers are going to get money to film their projects, where the audiences are getting more and growing all the time, and where people are paying attention to this country. And I was thinking,
this is Bolivia, right?
Yeah, Bolivia. Yeah, and and I'm thinking, well, are they being a bit naughty here with how they're telling this? They could be upsetting a lot of people. And then later, when we see a real twist in the story in this country, ends up playing quite a different role, I thought, that all makes sense now.
Yeah, well, remember,
obtuse here.
There is only one thing worse than being talked about, let's face it.
Exactly. Okay. Now.
And at least they did get mentioned. Sorry, there's an and now then, and I stepped all over it shamelessly.
No. I mean, I think the other thing that people will really discuss about this film is the ending. It does, I thought, turn the story on its head. It was a twist. That's all good. And it is, we are talking about a sci-fi film, so the rules of the normal world don't apply. But I don't want to spoil it. There's a lot of emotion involved in the ending. It's all about examining what it is to be human. And that's all potentially very rewarding, Steve. But for all that, I just felt it a leap too far.
Yes.
My initial reaction was, oh, this is almost silly. I'm almost going to use the word ludicrous. That's a bit unfair. But to pull all the strands of the story together in the way they did, it was a step too far. It almost made me think this was a non-sci-fi ending at the end of a sci-fi story.
Yeah, I know what you mean. A good sci-fi story should actually have a human element in it, shouldn't it, really?
Yeah, of course it does. Yes,
but
yes.
You need to be very, very careful how you do that. And I can definitely sympathise with your concerns there. Did it earn the denouement?
Well, I just think it was almost a denouement to it could have been. I don't want to give it. It's so difficult to find the words without giving it away. But basically,
it is difficult to talk about this one without talking about it.
One thing I'll say, Steve, is that I can imagine people having vastly contrasting reactions to it.
Yeah.
Where I was watching it, and there were some people almost guffawing.
Oh dear!
at
oh
the
dear.
End. And others though were really completely absorbed and wrapped up in it. So it's the type of film and the type of ending which I'm sure will divide opinion. And for that reason, I think you and I will disagree on this. I would actually recommend people seeing it. I still found it overall quite a classily put together piece of work. It is thought-provoking. I didn't buy the ending, but I wouldn't say to someone, don't go and see it. I think if you're into sci-fi at all, I would recommend seeing it. You might not say that.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, yeah, look, here's one little issue I had with it, and this is something that most people won't find fault with, but I have a background in linguistics. I used to be an English teacher, and I know a thing or two about this. And there's an awful lot of, okay, we'll let that slide because it works with the logic of the film. But there is one key issue. There was one key pivotal point where she makes reference to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and that is the crux upon which the narrative turns. And it is a complete and utter misunderstanding. And I actually wanted to start throwing things at the screen. And I know this is going to sound hideously petty and picky, and it's like someone saying, oh, yes, of course, that couldn't possibly be right, because that motorcycle in the background was making the wrong noise for a 1967 model. But it's not that. This is the entire central premise upon which the story hinges.
And they
got it completely and utterly wrong. And I actually got a little bit cross at that point. All the other stuff about how she was going to be able to communicate with aliens. I mean, it's a lovely one to chew around. And in all likelihood, you probably wouldn't make it work. But you don't care because it's a part of the story. But no. Key linguistics point. Key central point in sociolinguistics. Largely debunked anyway. Completely misrepresented. And that's the crux of your story. And I got a little bit cross. But that's just me because I'm a geek.
Ah! Oh, no. That's not the right word at all. But...
Oh, you're very kind.
I really would be interested to hear some of our thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners would perhaps, get in touch with us, tell us what they think. That would be really interesting.
There must be at least one professor of linguistics listening to this, apart from me, of course, listening to this. And, I have to be honest, in the end, I was sort of sketching out the opening line of a review in my head as I walked out of the cinema, and I decided not to use it in the end for a review because it was going to be too clunky, but I'll share it with you right now. Don't tell anyone else that I said this, though, right?
Right.
But yeah. I figured you could start off and you say that they should change the ratings information to say caution nudity, because there is an emperor walking around this film with absolutely no clothes on.
Oh.
This is... You look at the online reviews, looking,
there are
apparently other critics. I find this hard to believe, but apparently there are. And they're fawning over this film. It's sensitive and it's brilliant and it's wonderful and it's powerful. And no, it was functional.
Yeah. Okay. I saw those other reviews too. And I might have agreed with them, but as we've just discussed, the ending just didn't work for me, and I felt very disappointed because I wanted to like it more than I ended up liking it. So, I'm going to need a cup of tea after all this chat, Steve.
Absolutely. We'll tell you what. I mean, bottom line is, do we buy a ticket for this film?
Well, see, I do.
You reckon?
And you don't. Yeah, I do. Yes.
I wait to download it. Wait till it comes out on Netflix or something. Save. It's worth seeing, but it's not that worth seeing.
All right, we'll move on then.
I think we move on to one significantly less controversial and more likely to unite opinion. Let's go to Nocturnal Animals.
Oh, well, I don't know if it will unite us. Should I just do a quick... A quick summary, if there's such a thing, of this film, because it is...
Go on. Best of luck to you. I'm not convinced yeah, you're going to sum this up summarily, but have at it.
I'll have at it. Well, I'll just quickly mention there's an opening scene in this film. It hits you right between the eyes. It's unconventional. It's provocative.
It's gratuitous. Yeah. Utterly gratuitous.
Yeah, it does. I suppose what it's trying to do is to force us to examine, what is culturally acceptable depictions of the human body. That's what it's trying to do. But yes, it may be gratuitous. But anyway, the story. Right. So Amy Adams, she's back, and this time she is an art gallery owner called Susan Morrow, who, while in a troubled marriage with her second husband, receives a manuscript from the writer and a writer who is her first husband, a guy called Edward, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal.
Now, or possibly Gyllenhaal, we're not sure.
Gyllen. Yeah, I'm so sorry, Jake. Yeah,
Jake.
So this launches the film basically into, well, I took it to be three stories which have all been told simultaneously. You've got first the present, which is Susan reading the novel, reacting to it, working out how it might affect her life. Second, the past, because we are looking back at how her first marriage came about and then fell over. And then third, there's the fictional aspect. This is the telling of Edward's manuscript, which is titled Nocturnal Animals. So there's these three threads going through. Driving the story is the mystery behind Susan's previous relationship with Edward. How is this being played out in Edward's novel? And this is basically how the drama rolls along. And my thoughts were that, you know, there's a director here called Tom Ford. He's a pretty well-known guy. He's a former fashion designer. He basically comes up with a pretty dark psychological thriller. It's at times extremely violent. My take on this, Steve, I did find it riveting. It was quite disturbing at times. And this, too, has an ending which some may or may not be happy with. I liked the ending. I didn't expect it to be a nice, neat, tidy ending, and I didn't think it necessarily was, but I liked that. That's my initial summary. What about you?
Well, again, I don't really know what to make of it. You say there are three films in here, or three stories at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, to be fair, the central story is the Nocturnal Animals novel manuscript that Susan receives from Edward. Yeah. And it's brilliant. It's very, very tightly played out. It's got some amazing acting in it. In particular, we have to give credit to Michael Shannon as Bobby Andes, the detective who is, as he says, I look into things around here. And the thing he's looking into around here is a horrible, horrible episode in which a husband and wife and their teenage daughter driving through West Texas at night are run off the road by a gang of thugs who abuse them horribly in one of the tensest, tautest, and most uncomfortable scenes I have seen in a long time. And it was told absolutely beautifully. It was immersive. It was shocking. It was very unsettling. Amazing acting going on there. When we saw that story going on, it was brilliant. It was very conventionally done. It was shot in very, very stark, brilliant colour. You've got phenomenal acting from. I don't think it's too unfair to point out that the father of the family is played also by Jake,
yes,
with the unpronounceable surname. Isla Fisher plays the wife, and who's the daughter? Ellie Bamber plays the daughter, right. India. And that's an absolutely compelling story, and that really is, that's the centre of the film, that's the heart of the film. And then we also see Susan's reactions to it, and I found that to be so mannered and so stiltedly stylized that I just couldn't get into her. She was almost
interesting.
Almost aloof and remote, and she was a cold character. Young Susan, when she was still married to Edward, was an altogether more interesting character who had passion and fire to her.
Yes. Well, we've got to disagree again. Isn't this good? By the way, Steve, the other actor we should mention in that gripping novel sequence is Aaron Taylor Johnson, who
I
plays.
I knew you were going to mention. He was fantastic, wasn't he?
He plays the lead of the thugs, and boy, he really gives a degree of menace to that. And as you say, you're just squirming in your seat. It is a very, very effective piece of.
There is one scene where briefly the camera lingers on Taylor Johnson's face as he is mocking the dad of the family. Tony is the character's name.
Tony, yeah.
And he's just mocking him. And there's the very slightest curl of the lip and sneer. And a shiver went down my spine when they showed that. I thought, my God, I mean, I hope he's acting. Because if he's not, he is a very, very troubled man. It's an amazing performance from him. He's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I thought that whole story, the Nocturnal Animals novel,
yes.
It made me think of the sort of work maybe a writer like Cormac McCarthy did with No Country for Old Men. It had that sort of real edgy, modern Western, violent feel to it.
Yes, yes.
And it was very, very good. Now, I'll take issue with you on how that sat with the rest of the film. because I think it was meant to be different. And I think the reason that later, as you say, Susan, in the present day is kind of cooler, colder, more reflective, not as emotive in her reactions to things, is because she, as Amy Adams plays her, is reading this novel and we're watching it, all the while realizing that what she did as a younger, more emotional, tempestuous woman is being played out in the story she's reading, because the author, her earlier husband, Jake, is pouring in some of his feelings about her into the story. And so she's having to absorb all this information. I didn't mind that. I thought that she is having to sort of somehow portray a massive internal battle about what she's done in the past and whether it's going to haunt her for the rest of her life, and what will she ever be able to perhaps repair what she's done wrong in the past. And rather than do this I'll use the word I used earlier with Arrival. She doesn't rely on histrionics here. It's kind of smaller movements. And I like that. Maybe I'm just kind of getting to like Amy Adams, but I thought that was okay for me. But we'll disagree on that.
No, you're absolutely right. She is a fantastic actress, and she did play, again, a somewhat thin role with an awful lot of warmth. And I did like what she brought to it. But again, she found herself sort of trying to fill in an awful lot that wasn't really there in the character. I felt it was very, very broad strokes. As I say, especially the modern day stuff, it was stark and stylized and cold, and characters were tossed in for no reason. Tell me about her daughter.
We won't give too much away here, but we do see her modern day daughter for one scene, and that becomes a part of the real mystery of the story, and there is some understanding of how that all fits together near the end. I don't think we were meant to know a hell of a lot about her. We didn't. You're right. We didn't. We don't find out much about the daughter. The fact that the coldness of the storytelling, if you like, Steve, that you didn't sit well with you. I guess that was part of a slowly building reveal to what happens at the end. And even at the end, we don't know everything. You're right. It was kind of teasing. It didn't give all the answers. I was happy to go along with that. You mentioned the visuals. I mean, there's kind of some David Lynch type sort of imagery here, isn't there? Or some oddness and weirdness to the way.
Yeah.
The modern day story is depicted, which, as you rightly say, such a stark contrast to the novel, the Western novel. You are watching several stories at the same time. I wanted to know what was going to happen. It certainly held my attention. I wanted to know how it was all going to be tied up. What about the ending? How did it sit with you?
You don't need to have every single question answered at the end of a film. You don't need to walk away going, okay, I know exactly how that resolved itself. You don't need that. But I can't help but feel that it's almost as though Ford was being a little bit smug with us, going, I'm just going to leave it to you to figure that one out. And no, I don't know that they've given us enough bones of the story for us to put the flesh on ourselves. I'm not convinced that it was a completely satisfying ending.
Okay. All right. And there's one other scene in the film, which I think was, thinking about it later, was possibly one of the most pivotal scenes, was where the character of Susan, we see her discussing her future with her mother, as played by Laura Linney.
Oh, yes.
I thought Laura Linney did a really good job in that scene.
Didn't she just?
A great cameo. But that was actually a very, to my understanding of the story, was an absolutely pivotal moment.
Yes.
In terms of what's going on here and what will play out in the future. You're right. We don't. There are questions left not completely answered by a long chalk. I just thought it was that. I just took it to be that's the type of film this is. It's not going to be a completely satisfying wrap up. It's going to leave you dangling a little bit and trying to work things out. I just bought into it, I guess. Maybe I'm being a bit too, what's the word, accommodating to these directors, Steve.
I think you're going soft, Simon.
anyway. Oh! Now, can you hear that?
You've got a Bruce Springsteen ringtone on your phone, haven't you?
No, I haven't. I'm so sorry. Never mind. I shall deal with that. This is what happens when you do a podcast. Things happen, like phones ring. Anyway, it's off now. So, here's the question. Would you buy a ticket for it, Steve?
Would I buy a ticket for it? Yes, because I think there's enough... Although it's largely surface and it's largely style, the style is so good that, yeah, I think it's worth seeing.
I do too. We will disagree over the content of this, but I do too. Okay, we agree on that to a certain extent. Isn't it nice when we don't say the same things all the time?
yes, it is.
Right, yes. So this is Crave. And Steve, the last few weeks, Steve, you've been flying the music flag for our podcast all by yourself. You've done it again last week. Tell me about your night out with your hometown band, James.
James are a band who I go a long way back with. And the last time I saw them was in Manchester in 19, I believe 90. And it's interesting to compare the two shows. That show was at the GMEX Centre, which is comparable, I guess, to Auckland's Vector Arena. It's a full-size arena. And James were at the height of their powers. And they were touring successful albums, and they were doing very well, and they filled the venue out. And obviously in their hometown, it was quite fantastic. It was a great show. And I kind of lost track of them for a while. And then they played their first ever New Zealand show last week. They came to Auckland, and they played the Power Station, which is, I don't know, you could consider it a step down. But the reality is that, you know, not every band can remain at the absolute top of their business game forever. But they're still making very good music.
Right.
So if anyone's got any interest, go back a couple of weeks to the interview I did with Tim Booth, the lead singer.
And he talks
He talks a bit about the music then. And it was fascinating to actually see them on stage again. They're older men now. These are men in their 50s. But they still play with astonishing energy. And I was really, really glad I went. As it was a much smaller venue. I was down at the front for photography. Shots from the show on the website at cravepodcast.com. And I saw a band who are clearly very, very comfortable with what they do. They don't need to be playing in a huge, enormous arena any longer. They can fill a club like the Power Station and fill it with energy quite amazingly. And I really, really enjoyed the show. Tim Booth is still doing his we really need to get the meds on him very, very quickly, kind of spazzy dance that he's been doing for years, and the audience love it every time he does it. The set list, as he talked about in the interview, he puts together an hour before they go on stage.
Right.
And I was astonished that they didn't play their single biggest hit, Sit Down, which was a little bit of a disappointment. But we did hear songs like Come Home, or Laid, which was their big breakthrough hit in the 90s in America. But all I can say is a fantastically entertaining show, and I am really, really glad I went.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And just look, sorry, just to backtrack one step, just for those of us who haven't come across James much, I think a lot of New Zealanders wouldn't necessarily know much about them. Was this a rocky up tempo show?
Very much. Yeah. I mean, they were sort of like indie pop rock was kind of how they were badged all those years ago, and so you know you've got two guitarists, a trumpeter, a keyboard player, all these things you expect from a classic indie rock band. Give them a listen.
Good stuff.
Give them a listen.
Okay. Lovely. Great. Excellent. Oh, well, that's good. That's good.
Well, I was out clubbing it. You were at home reading, weren't you?
yes, I was. And if you know anything about my musical taste, you'll be no surprise to hear the book which I've been reading. It is, yes, Bruce Springsteen's autobiography, 7 years in the writing, unsurprisingly titled Born to Run. And I did mention that earlier on, Steve, this book's actually been out for some time, well over a month, to 6 weeks ago. And here's me talking about it. You know, why am I talking about it now? Well, I made a mistake. I guess, rather than buy it off a local bookseller,
yeah,
I ordered it in advance months ago.
Oh, okay.
From a US-based Springsteen website called Backstreets. That's a website I've read for many years. It does a great job. I have ordered products from it before, and I thought, oh, I'll stay loyal to you guys. I'll order this. But it just took a long time to arrive, and it's only after I sent them an email that I get this reply that Hurricane Matthew, which struck the US a little while ago, had held up their shipments overseas. It had disrupted their ability to send stuff away. So here's me, you know, sitting, waiting. Everyone else is reading it, and I thought I'll wait for my copy to arrive. So yeah,
and so the human cost of Hurricane Matthew even reached Auckland.
That's incredible.
But the question has to be asked then: was it everything that you dreamt it was going to be?
Oh, that's a big question. Pretty close. I know you're going to say I would say that. Look, I'll try and keep my thoughts brief because I don't want to keep talking until next Tuesday. But I think the main thing to say, Steve, this does give a what appears to be a very frank insight,
right,
into what makes him tick, which I guess is what you want from an autobiography. I mean, I heard his music. I was really aware of his stuff back in 78. I was 18. The first song I heard, I remember it was Adam Raised a Cane. It was right from that album, Darkness on the Edge of Town. I liked the song, but the way he sang it, I just remember hearing this guy who was singing as if his life depended on it.
Right.
And it just really resonated with me immediately. And I, you know, over the years, he's built this reputation on his songs, this powerful rock singer. And the songs are insightful. They're often misunderstood. And he's built his reputation on his stagecraft. You know, these long, long shows full of emotion for him and his audience.
Well, I mean, he famously plays for several hours at a time,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I just maybe naively thought, this seems to be a bloke who has some integrity, who doesn't generally appear to have fallen into the celebrity pitfalls of other big-name rock stars. I know he certainly hasn't gone into the drugs scene as others have. He seems to have, in what he's said and the money he's raised for various, you know, food banks, charities, Vietnam vets, he seems to be a guy who's aware of his roots and has stuck to his guns. And I just wondered, what's all this about? And there's been lots of books written about him, but to hear what he's had to say, I found very interesting. And, well, look, no surprises that his early years obviously were extremely important. He was brought up in a pretty poor family. His grandparents actually brought him up at first for quite a while. And this is interesting because his grandparents had lost a child very early on and at a very early age. They overloved him, Steve. They put no boundaries on him.
Bruce is a spoiled brat.
He was, for his first, at the age of about two or three, he could stay up as late as he liked. He could sleep all day. And then he goes back to live with his parents. And that creates all this turmoil. And he goes into an environment where there's a poor, hardworking family. His mother does most of the work. His father drifts in and out of jobs. His father's a manic depressive. You'll have heard in other reviews how Springsteen himself was battling depression for various stages through his adult life. And so very early in this book, Steve, on page 11, I made a note of it, as early as page 11, when he's talking about this unconditional love he got from his grandparents, and then that all changes, he says that itself was hugely important to turning him into who he was. So can I just read a very, very short passage? Will you bear with me?
I'd be fascinated to hear a sample of his prose.
Okay, so he says, "The grinding hypnotic power of this ruined place and these people would never leave me. I visited in my dreams today, returning over and over, wanting to go back. It was a place where I felt an ultimate security, full license, and a horrible, unforgettable, boundaryless love. It ruined me and it made me. Ruined in that for the rest of my life I would struggle to create boundaries for myself that would allow me a life of some normalcy in my relationships. It made me in the sense that it would set me off on a lifelong pursuit of a singular place of my own, giving me a raw hunger that drove me hell-bent in my music. It was a desperate, lifelong effort to rebuild on embers of memory and longing my temple of safety."
And today's reading is from chapter 3, verse 11 of the Book of St. Bruce of Asbury Park.
Yes, who, of course, was Catholicism played a huge part in his early life. You can tell by the way he's written it, can't you?
It does have a certain Catholic ring to it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's a good lyricist. We know he writes a decent song every now and then. And yeah. So you'd expect him to be able to write well. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, the rest of the story, Elvis and the Beatles knock him for six. He wasn't really good at school, a bit of a misfit, a bit of a loner. But he just found this place in music. And Steve, apart from a short stint mowing lawns as a kid, he has had no other job in his whole life other than being a musician.
Wow.
But he still can't read music.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I mean, there's all sorts of stuff here. But I think the thing here is he's pretty open about his own faults, as far as you can tell. He's mostly generous to others. The writing can be beautifully phrased and quite incisive. Sometimes he gets a bit carried away and gets overlong and rather bombastic, but, you know, I think you can forgive that. I realized at the end of the Steve that I hadn't actually read many or any other rock star autobiographies, like I know Pete Townsend's done one not that long ago, and so I can't really compare it to others, but because I know quite a bit about him, I was utterly drawn in. I wanted to know more. He gave me an insight into the workings of his mind. It didn't probably answer every question that everyone would want to have answered, but it told story, told with a degree of integrity. I lapped it up, and if you have any interest at all in his music, I would recommend it.
Well, the only problem with a story like this, of course, is it's a story to date, and so it won't have a story that's just come out of New Jersey, where apparently he broke down on his motorcycle and ended up having to get a ride from a biker gang to a local bar.
Oh, I missed that one. Oh, okay.
It's in the papers today.
I have missed that.
It says, after a Veterans Day event on Friday, a chap named Dan Barkalow said he saw a stranded motorcyclist up ahead near All Air State Park in Wall Township. And he said, "Biker's got to stick together. I stopped to see if he needed help, and it was Bruce."
He loves it. That's great.
Yes.
He'll be feeling sad about something else, because he just a week ago endorsed and gave a public performance in support of Hillary Clinton, and that all bit rather went sour for
Simon,
him.
Simon, this podcast was supposed to be my safe place. We were supposed to avoid mentioning the trauma that one of my adopted countries recently inflicted upon itself.
Well, that's true. That it is Brexit, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyway,
the thing that couldn't possibly happen, but then in hindsight was utterly inevitable. Yes. So we need the release of our films and our music to take our mind off things. We do.
Oh, sorry to spoil it. I did mention, but we haven't used the T word yet, and I won't use it myself.
No. Let's not.
Anyway, so speaking of films and music, okay, what else do we have on the menu in the next week or two, Steve? I'm just trying to think what's coming up.
Well, there's some interesting things coming up very, very shortly. Will I be seeing you at the preview of the new Harry Potter film, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them?
I will see it. I won't be able to make the preview with you, but I will see it, Steve, because that we must discuss that next time for sure.
That's probably the single biggest cinematic thing coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the thing that perhaps what's interesting about that, Steve, is the people who first absorbed Harry Potter as kids.
Yes.
How old are they now?
I'm trying to think.
Are they 20s now or something like that?
I think the first Harry Potter novel came out about 25 years ago. Yes.
Yeah. So there'll be at least that, and maybe in their 30s. It'd be really interesting to hear from a kid, or someone who was a kid when they got into Harry Potter,
yes,
to see how they now absorb this story. That would be fascinating. That would be great.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, I mean, there's also coming up very shortly, we've got The Founder, which is, on paper, it sounds dreadful. It's the story of Ray Kroc, who effectively founded the McDonald's chain. Of things, but Michael Keaton plays the titular Mr. Kroc.
And
that's got the potential to be very, very good.
Yeah, the trailer's been out and about in the movie theaters for a bit, and it just looks like the absolutely classic American business story, doesn't it?
It really does look a bit special, yes.
Yeah, that looks good. Oh, yeah, I'll definitely look forward to seeing that too. Great stuff.
Yeah, in terms of music, I'm trying to think. There's one big event coming up. The Cult, another of my childhood favourites. Nice bit of classic gothic heavy metal rock. Was originally meant to have been at the Logan Campbell Centre in Auckland on Monday the 21st of November. They've shifted to the Power Station because apparently ticket sales were going really, really nicely for them. So they shifted over to the Power Station, and I'm hoping to be there for that. We've got, I know it's a little bit further out, but we'll mention it anyway. We've got the Monkees are going to be playing on the 30th.
Yeah,
in Auckland, and there's one that we haven't mentioned much so far, but I'd like to plug it a little bit, just simply because it's a hometown thing for me. Here in Pukekohe, south of Auckland, not South Auckland, obviously, but in south of Auckland, we've got coming up in March of next year the Stampede Music Festival.
Okay.
I know Pukekohe is not the obvious place you'd expect to go to for a country music festival, but down at the racetracks, just outside town here, where the V8 races are held now, the powers that be have decided to turn that into a music festival. So we've got the Stampede Music Festival. So far, we've got confirmed Leanne Rimes. That well-known.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yes.
Decently big name there. And Scotty McCreary, who apparently is a country singer. I'm not terribly familiar. Local acts, we've got The Legends, we've got The Waratahs, Dennis March, Jodie Doreen, Cooper's Run. I mean, there's a decent-looking lineup for the show.
Yeah.
And like I say, it's in Pukekohe, so I'm keen to promote it.
Oh, very good, very good. Hey, by the way, Steve, have you and I talked on here, or I'm just trying to think, maybe when I was on afternoons at RNZ, I can't remember now, the local band called Tiny Ruins.
You've mentioned them in passing, yes.
Yeah, because they've got a, I think they came in and did a show when I was on afternoons, and they've got something coming up in early December. They've toured overseas. They're a three or four piece. Holly Fulbrook is the name of the lead singer and writer of the what's going on there. And that's, there's a show coming up, which I'm just having a quick look here because I just saw the poster on it when I was now, there's a famous movie theatre in Auckland, well, relatively famous, called the Hollywood Cinema. It's in the suburb of Avondale.
Okay.
And on Friday, December the 2nd and Saturday, December the 3rd, there's a big musical festival and movies and food and blah, blah, blah. And Tiny Ruins are the headline act. On the Friday, December the 2nd, they play with the Support Carnivorous Plant Society.
Wonderful name for a band.
Yes, and on Saturday, December the 3rd, Lawrence Arabia.
Yes.
So that could well be worth a little check out, I would imagine.
Very definitely, yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot coming up, as there always is. We've talked for a long time, Mr. McCabe.
We have. How indeed, Mr. Mercer.
So this is Crave that you've been listening to. We'll be back again very soon with more about music and film. We'd love to hear from you, especially what you think about Arrival and Nocturnal Animals. You can send us an email at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can reach us on Facebook, and you can find us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
I'm Simon Mercep.
I'm Steve McCabe.
He is, I am, and that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Much better, much better, much better.